You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning, everyone, and happy Canada Day. I haven't completely lost my mind. Today, we are going to celebrate what it is to be Canadian. I hope that today will get your patriotic juices flowing in anticipation of our actual Canada Day coming up in a few weeks' time. So we will celebrate, but we will do so in context, for our history has not been all roses. We'll also take some time to acknowledge some of our shortcomings as a nation. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas, of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. You know, it took West Hill over 2 years, from 2015 to 2017, to read out each one of the 94 calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. A new commission was just released this past week. Elizabeth Renzetti wrote an evocative piece in yesterday's Globe and Mail about the final report from the National Inquiry into the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, the result of more than 2,000 survivors and family members sharing their trauma. The 231 calls to justice in that report demand reform, policing, health, and welfare systems. If we start next week, if you do the math, reading one of those every Sunday, we should be done in about 4.5 years. The report also makes simple and profound requests from all Canadians that we take the time to learn about Indigenous history and the crushing consequence of colonialism and misogyny. Thank you, Ruth Gill and Steve Watson and everyone in our First Nations group for helping us to do just that. You not only effectively raised our collective awareness of the issue and our complicity, but you took that important message directly to Ottawa. Renzetti highlights one radical concept contained in the calls to justice that will resonate with you all, I think. Quote, create time and space for relationships based on respect as human beings, supporting and embracing differences with kindness, love, and respect. What madness, she proclaims. Maybe partly because she might wonder why such a self-evident or obvious statement needs to be put in the report. Now, I don't think that came directly from our vision works. But it could have. It could have. For those of you wanting to know more about what goes on here at West Hill, our vision works is a statement of our values about how we want to live in this world and to make a difference. And I invite you all to check that out on westhill.net anytime and from time to time. Readings, three brief ones. First one by Lorraine Monk. The search for Canada is a personal journey. The search for a national identity is a journey without an end. It began a long, long time ago. It will continue into the far distant future. Second reading by Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Sometimes we peer suspiciously at each other. So suspiciously at each other that we cannot see that we Canadians are standing on the mountaintop of human wealth, freedom, and privilege. And lastly, just because it's always nice to feel good when a celebrity says something nice about us Canadians, you know, by Jane Fonda. When I'm in Canada, she says, I feel this is what the world should be like. Isn't that kind of cute? Offer it as wisdom for the journey. And now for our focused moment. There was a time in this fair land when the railroad did not run, when the wild, majestic mountain stood alone against the sun, long before the white man and long before the wheel, when the dark green forest was too silent to be real. But time has no beginnings, and history has no bounds. As to this verdant country, they came from all around. We came from all around. Some of you will recognize that as the opening lyrics to Gordon Lightfoot's Canadian Railroad Trilogy. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to you our guest speaker today. Joey Taylor is a Toronto-based radio personality, writer, public speaker, and the creator of the Six String Nation Project. As a radio broadcaster, producer, writer, and host, he is best known for CBC Radio's weekly music and news program titled Global Village. You probably heard that sometime between 1997 and 2007. He also hosted and co-produced the eight-part series The Wire, The Impact of Electricity on Music, and his follow-up six-part series The Nerve, Music and the Human Experience. And for his work in radio, he has received many prestigious awards. In 2015, he was awarded the Meritorious Service Medal by then Governor General David Johnston for Six String Nation's contribution to Canadian culture. It is my pleasure to introduce and ask you to give a warm Westhillian welcome to Joey Taylor. Joey.
Thank you so much.
You can obviously see this is going to be a visual presentation as much as anything else. So we're going to turn off all the lights. We can't turn off the windows, but we'll make it as dark as we can so we can thoroughly enjoy this.
We're having that weird problem again where the sound isn't coming out of the laptop, and it needs to because you're going to need to hear some stuff. I'm just going to turn this down for a second. I'm going to plug it back in, and hopefully... There we go. Okay. Thank you very much, Tim. That amount of music is usually long enough to get me from far off to this point, so it's a little bit shorter today. Thank you so much for having me. Listening to everything that was said, I kept thinking, oh, there's a part in the presentation that really fits to that, talks to that. We could be here all day. I'll try and move through it a little bit quickly. And thank you for staying. This is a picture of my grandmother and my sister and my mom and me in 1967 at Expo in Montreal. I'm wearing my African shirt. Legitimately, I was born in Uganda, and I'm wearing the sombrero that I got at the Mexican Pavilion. 1967 Expo was an amazing event. The world came to Canada, and really, it was our chance to step onto the stage in a new way, not as this kind of sort of stodgy colonial drawers of water, hewers of wood kind of place, but really as a very dynamic and inclusive country. Of course, we weren't alone in having this new sense of optimism and inclusiveness in the world. It was 67, lots of things were going on. The Summer of Love in San Francisco, which is actually a weather phenomenon. It was exceptionally warm in 1967 in many parts of the world, and it meant people stayed out longer and there was more festivals and all that kind of thing. It's the year that Sgt. Pepper by the Beatles was released. Christian Barnard did the world's first heart transplant in South Africa. Airbus in France introduced the world's first supersonic passenger jet, the Concorde. So you can, all this kind of optimism and looking towards the future. The anti-Vietnam protests really had kind of reached their peak, and as I hate to remind everyone, it was also, of course, the last year that the Leafs won the Cup. You got to include that. I'm sorry. But it was also the first year that we saw this picture. It's the first. This was actually not taken by NASA. It was taken by the U.S. Department of Defense from a satellite. And it was the first time we had ever seen a whole picture of our planet. And it really gave people the opportunity to recognize this is our place. We all share this. You don't see any borders on this image. You don't see any wars on this image. It was a year later that Stuart Brand convinced the U.S. Department of Defense to let him put this on the cover of the first edition of the Whole Earth catalog in 1968. 1968, of course, then was the year that Pierre Trudeau got elected as Prime Minister. Again, a sense of a cosmopolitanism and optimism in our country. And a year later, he was hosting in Montreal, or went to visit anyway, as John Lennon and Yoko did their bed-in, which ended just 50 years ago, just this past week. Kind of extraordinary when you think about it. But of course, it doesn't take long for a pendulum to swing. So by 1987, the Prime Minister of Britain, Margaret Thatcher, said this: "There's no such thing as society. There are individual men and women, and there are families. People must look after themselves first." Now, you know that's not true. I know that's not true. I don't see how any sane person could think that this was true. By your very congregation, you know that that's true. We are congregational beings, and that's what makes us who we are. It was also the year that Oliver Stone released his movie Wall Street, which, although it was a critique of the financial system, it ended up being a bit of a celebration of this guy, Gordon Gekko, whose phrase, "greed is good," became a kind of a clarion call to a whole generation. It was the first year, 1987, that Forbes released their billionaires list. And in 1987, there were 140 billionaires in the world. Fast forward 10 years, and you've got 220 billionaires in the world. Measured as of 2017, there were 2,200 billionaires in the world. And with that, we find that the world's 8 richest people own as much as the poorest 3.5 billion people. The amount of money stored in offshore investments and things like that is $17 trillion. Here's what that looks like with zeros on. That's wealth that's just hiding from the public, from people. That's what happened in those 20 years. Those 40 years since 1967. 50 years? Oh my goodness, yeah, 50 years, sorry. But also, these kinds of things happened. We find that the rejection of immigrants as neighbors, rates against that sort of began to rise in Europe and the United States. The number of hate groups continued to rise. That dip that you see there around 2013, 2014 coincides with Obama's presidency. And then, of course, it starts to rise again. And here in Canada, we've seen a rise in hate crimes for various motivations, against transgender people, against all kinds of sexual orientation, race, religion, you name it. This is not the Canada that I thought awaited me in 1967 in my sombrero and my African shirt. And I wanted to... it was funny you mentioned that quote by Pierre Trudeau saying, you know, we eye each other with suspicion, not realizing we're on the summit of wealth and privilege. And I wanted to do something that would remind us who we really are, what's really foundational about Canada, that diversity really is our strength, that we are greater than the sum of our parts. The spur for me to do this was 1995, when we were eyeing each other with suspicion. Quebec was considering, was about to embark on a referendum to separate from the rest of Canada. And although I understood that impulse, it also disappointed me that this was not a wide conversation about all the different ways there are to be Canadian. It just came down to French versus English, Quebec versus Ottawa, red versus blue. And where were everyone else's voice in that? And particularly, where were the voices of Indigenous people, who I thought had a much greater claim to this territory that they were scrapping over? And so I had this idea when I met this luthier who was trying to build a guitar just using pieces from his property, which I thought was a kind of patriotic thing to do. And I had this idea that maybe we could build a guitar that would bring the country together by including something from everywhere. But it really wasn't until I met Shingoose, Curtis Johnny, who's a guitar player and new media producer from Winnipeg, First Nations guy, and I said, if I was to get something from First Nations people in Manitoba to go into this guitar, what would it be? Thinking he would tell me about a particular kind of wood, you know? And instead he said something extraordinary. He said, I think you should get a piece of a residential school. If you could do that, sorry, this happens to me all the time. If you could do that, this would be a really healing guitar, a really powerful instrument. So that really set me on a new course, because I realized I wasn't so much gathering stuff as I was gathering stories. And I set about talking to more people and gathering more information and collecting the pieces that you see on the screen here. Now, I know they don't look like much, and in fact, some of these things aren't much. Some of these things are construction scrap, or picked up off the bottom of Halifax Harbor, or off of the tundra in northern Canada. The point is that each and every one of these pieces, from the famous to the not famous, tells a story. And every single one of these pieces is part of this guitar. So in total, I gathered 64 pieces for the project originally. Those comprise the guitar. We've since added a bunch to the case and the strap, and I'll mention some of those in particular later. We officially nicknamed the guitar Voyageur in 2008 at the Festival de Voyageur in February. February in Winnipeg, people, let me tell you, there's a Canadian experience right there. This is Lieutenant Colonel Susan Bahariel of the Canadian Armed Forces. She's the person who suggested the name Voyageur, and we brought her out to the festival to be part of that naming ceremony. We still keep in touch today. So I don't have time to tell you about all the pieces, but I can take you inside and give you a sense of how this whole thing works. Canada's largest province, of course, the province of Quebec. Most of what we ever hear about Quebec happens somewhere along the St. Lawrence at the bottom there, but it's huge. I'm not sure you even know that the northern part of Quebec is known as Nunavik. This is the Inuit territory of Quebec. It's pretty sparsely populated in terms of people, pretty heavily populated in terms of caribou. That's actually the low number census. It goes up to about 1 million depending on the year. So you can imagine caribou is a big part of life in Nunavik. Diet, fashion, economy, culture, you name it. I found a young artist from Kujawak, Nunavik, and she carved for us this ulu, a women's knife. Now this is just a tiny little ornamental one. It's made from caribou antler with a couple little soapstone rivets in there. And this little ornamental ulu is now right in the middle of the fifth fret. The guy holding the guitar in the picture just happens to be her father, Charlie Watt. He's a senator in Ottawa, or was until 2015. And he only found out that his daughter did this for us about an hour before we took this picture. So it's a very, very sweet moment. Oh my goodness, more than just a hockey player, right? A cultural icon. Perhaps the greatest Habs player ever. Top goal scorer in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. The Rocket. But he had kind of a rough year in the 54-55 season. It's March. They're in Boston at the Gardens for a game against the Bruins. And in a feud that had been going on all season, Richard got a stick in the head from this guy, Hal Lako. Might have been an accident, maybe not. He went after Hal Lako pretty hard. The refs came in to break up the fight. And in the course of that, he punched one of the refs. And he got kicked out of the game. it was the decision made by the commissioner of the league at the time, Clarence Campbell, an Anglo-Montrealer, originally from Saskatoon, actually. And as you can imagine, that decision did not sit well with Habs fans, who believed this was a deliberate attempt to ensure that a francophone team wouldn't win the Stanley Cup, because that's where they were headed, top of the league. So the day after Clarence Campbell issues this decree, he did something very, very provocative. He went to a game at the Montreal Forum. I don't know what he was thinking. He took his fiancée. Someone came up to him and said, "Sir, I'd like to shake your hand," but they didn't. They spat in his face. And then someone threw an egg, and then someone threw a tomato. And then somebody set off a tear gas canister, and the violence escalated, and it spilled out onto the streets. And these were the famous riots of Montreal in 1955, kind of the spark that lit the fuse of Quebec nationalism at the time. Richard had to be called in from his home in the suburbs just to calm people down and say, "It's only a game, I'll be back next year." Actually did okay without Richard. They were in the finals, and they made it seven games. But in the final seconds of the third period, Mr. Hockey himself, Gordie Howe, scored the deciding goal for the Detroit Red Wings. The year following, it turns out that the final was a rematch between Montreal and Detroit. There's no suspension against Richard. Who do you think it is in the second period of Game 5 who scores the deciding goal? It's our friend the Rocket, of course, and that marks the first of five Stanley Cups in a row back in Montreal, starting in 1956. Now, if you were on a Stanley Cup winning team at the time, the league would give you a silver platter. This looked terrific at home, but the Richard family wanted something you could show off a little bit easier. So they commissioned for the whole team a set of Stanley Cup rings, which the league wasn't giving out that year. This is the one they commissioned for the Rocket himself. You can see his number 9 down there in the Habs logo, and his name, the Stanley Cup on the front. On the other side, a little depiction of the Montreal Forum where they played. My friend Dave bought this ring at auction in 2004 when the Richard family was getting rid of some memorabilia. He paid $8,000 US for it, which I know his wife thought was a mistake. But then he made the real mistake, which was to tell me that he bought it. I begged and pleaded, and eventually, after I believe it was two Bloody Caesars, he let me take it down to the craft studio at Harborfront Center, where a young jeweler named Bevan Jennings cut a tiny bit of gold off the bottom of that ring. You'd never know it's gone. Buffed it up nice. It's now right in the middle of the 9th fret. So fret number 9 for number 9, and in fact I like to think that the 9th fret looks a bit like one of Maurice's famous blue eyes coming down the ice at you. The white of the eye is Moose Antler from Pick River First Nation on Lake Superior. The blue is Labradorite from Nain, Labrador, and then that little pupil of gold right in the middle. As already quoted from today, our 15th and 17th Prime Minister was a controversial and charismatic politician, and it doesn't really matter how you felt about him politically, because he really changed the game of what it meant to be a politician in Canada. But it was also this part of his life, as almost like a philosopher of the canoe, that I wanted to capture somehow in this project. Went to the Canoe Museum in Peterborough, but they were bankrupt at the time, couldn't even talk to anybody there, padlock on the door. But I bumped into one of his sons, I won't say which one just yet, let him know what I was trying to do, and he said, "I don't think we have anything left, I think it's all at that canoe museum, but give me a reminder call and I'll see what we can come up with." A little while later, I got this telephone message.
"Hi Joey, it's Justin Trudeau calling. I got your message and the guitar sounds like an amazing project. My brother and I had a look around and we found one of Dad's favorite paddles I think you can use. It's in kind of rough shape, not much use for a canoe trip anymore, but it may just sound fantastic in a guitar. Hope this helps. Keep in touch. Bye."
So he sent me the paddle. I sent that along to our luthier in Nova Scotia. And there it became the tone bar just inside the top of the sound hole. So you're looking at the inside of the guitar now. What amazes me, doesn't matter where I go in this country, including the oil patch, this is one of the pieces, that a lot of people really want to touch and connect to. Although, especially women, I find, for some reason. Still some prime ministerial mojo at play there, I think. And we did get it into Justin's hands a couple of Novembers ago. Got an invite to the office and did this portrait with him in front of the door there. John Ware was born into slavery in South Carolina in 1845. Lincoln signed the Emancipation Act in 1863. Now, he was already comfortable around horses, grew up around them. But in 63, he moved down to Texas, where he continued to work with horses in the cattle trade down there. Went from there up to Idaho, from Idaho to Montana. And from Montana, he joined one of the first cattle drives to Alberta. Worked for a while at the Bayou Ranch in Calgary, and then moved down to a little place called Brooks in southwestern Alberta, where he met, he brought out Mildred here, who grew up on King Street in Toronto. They started family. He had built a cabin that got washed away in a flood. He built another one. He was he became a very, very successful entrepreneur, a very savvy and popular local politician, and the best cow horse guy anyone had ever seen. Many of the events that you'll see in the Calgary Stampede today were invented by John Ware. He died in 1905, 12 days after Alberta became a province of Canada, and was the biggest funeral the young city of Calgary had ever seen. Lots of tributes to him, a place called John Ware Ridge, south of Calgary, lots of schools named after him. The great song by Diamond Joe White. Canada Post issued this stamp in his honor in 2015 for Black History Month. And his cabin's been preserved. They moved it just down the road a little ways from Brooks to Dinosaur Provincial Park. It's just inside the gates if you ever get a chance to go. I called them up and asked for something. They went into the cabin, cut off the end of one of the interior logs, sent that to me. That's now the top element on what we call the pickguard assembly. So you can see the pickguard's that kind of half of a maple leaf on the diagonal there. I can point out some of the other pieces. The stem of the maple leaf consists of four pieces. The one on the left is the top of Paul Henderson's hockey stick from the 1972 Canada-Russia Summit Series. I'm so glad not to be in a school where nobody knows who that is. Thank you so much. We did get this into Paul Henderson's hands a couple of Novembers ago as well. Lovely guy. Next to that, a piece of the Wildcat Cafe, the oldest original building in Old Town. Yellowknife first opened as a restaurant in 1936. Closed ever so briefly to fix the foundation a few years ago, but that gave me a chance to get this shot of the guitar amongst the logs they had piled across the street. It's all reassembled, back in business now in Yellowknife. Next to that, a seat from the aforementioned Old Montreal Forum, where the Habs used to play. Sadly, now the Forum Pepsi, home of an AMC theater and a Booster Juice and a Subway and whatever, Best Buy. Next to that, the top of Wayne Gretzky's stick, the great one. The side element kind of consists of three things. So you'll notice that there's a kind of a red stain on much of that. That's red ochre from Conception Bay, Newfoundland. So when the first Europeans arrived in Newfoundland, they found the native people there, the Beotuk or Beotic people. And they called them the Red Indians, which was fair because they called themselves the Red People. And that's because pretty much everything about them was red. Their clothing, their skin, their tools, their houses, their boats. That was red ochre. Was mixed with seal oil that was an incredible technology for protecting against that cold, damp Newfoundland weather. And such a successful technology was really adopted by the incoming Fisher culture as well. They used it. You'll still see that color on a lot of buildings. And in exchange for that gift, the Beotuk people got smallpox and were wiped out. So there's no more Beotuk people. That's there as a tribute to them. The outer portion of wood there is this kitchen rafter, a rafter from the kitchen of a home in Elmont, Ontario, belonging to one James Naismith. James Naismith, inventor of? Exactly. And, of course, also the namesake of the James Naismith Award, which goes to male and female college basketball players. You might actually recognize this former Naismith Award winner, two-time NBA MVP from Victoria. Right? Who's from Victoria here? There you go. You probably know who this is. Steve Nash, who was, of course, an amazing basketball player, really great soccer player, pretty decent filmmaker, and a terrible guitar player. Can't be good at everything, Steve. And come on, we cannot let this moment pass without just saying, let's go Raptors, right? Fantastic. The insert that you see there, back in 1955, they had two Made of the Mists in Niagara Falls, Ontario. They used those to go up to the falls there. How many people have been on Made of the Mist? Yeah, there you go, most of us, right? Well, they had two, Made of the Mist number two and number three. They were getting ready to put them in the water for the season. They caught fire. And they were pretty much totally destroyed, but they salvaged enough wood for Mailer the Mist number 2 that they made 38,000 of these wooden nickels that they sold to raise money to build the next Mailer the Mist. What I hate to report is that in 2014, after over 100 years in business, Mailer the Mist lost the contract to Hornblower of San Francisco, the California adventure company that will now take you up to the falls. You can still get a Mailer the Mist, but it runs from the U.S. side of things. I don't know about you, but I'm a huge fan of oysters. I wanted to represent Canada's very diverse oyster culture somehow in the project. Went down to Rodney's Oyster Bar on King Street, talked to Rodney. He's from PEI, still owns oyster beds out there. And I thought maybe he would suggest some piece of shell that we could get that was significant for some reason. And instead, he said, no, you should get something from Joe LeBobe. Joe LeBobe was Mi'kmaq from the Lenox Island First Nation. He was Canada's oyster shucking champion for a couple years. I'm actually going to let his widow tell his story, but keep your eye on her right hand in this little video.
In 1985 or 84, we went to the Oyster Festival, and I noticed they kept repeating anybody wants to shuck oysters to register. So I told him, I said, you go, Joe, go try it. You know, you never know. No, can't do that. Anyway, I talked him into it, and he went up and he paid his due, and he registered. So that's the first time he competed in the shucking oysters.
That gets the game. I remember we, Dad, he loved the water.
David Banks was the champion the year before. And three times they tied. There was always a tie between David and Joe. And anyway, finally the fourth time, Joe won him. And I thought the ring roof was going to fall apart. Everybody was roaring for Joe. Yeah, that's how he became an oyster shucker for Tyne Valley. So they sent him to Ireland. Well, the first time he was more of their, like he came sixth or seventh the first time. And the second time he went, he lost by 2 seconds.
That's the one that he won in Ireland. He had a crystal one.
Maybe the Irish give you a beer mug for a
couple. Oh, yeah. There's lots of beer being drank in there, too.
Oh, this is Joe's favorite oyster shucking knife. So we kept those. He's always sharpening them. He looked after them in Glitman. Since he's been gone, he's been laying around in the cupboard. Lot of memories.
If you want to pull down this audio channel now, you can do that because you know, it's been crackling away there. This is the oyster shucking knife that I think it's fair to say she was caressing throughout that interview. And, you know, I've watched that 1,000 times, and I'm so moved every time by this gesture and by the way she talks and how clear it is that she misses him. And, you know, I know some people find her a little bit awkward in that interview. And to be honest, I think she wondered why I came a long way across a muddy causeway on a rainy day to her tiny little house in Tyne Valley to get this little knife. But to me, this is what the whole project was about. I mean, you don't need me to tell you about hockey players or prime ministers, really. It's these stories that happen every day in communities right across this country that we are not good at celebrating widely, that we're not good at telling our own story and recognizing that it matters in our communities. That's how countries get made, is by people sharing those stories. And, you know, lest you think that the only people who would care about this particular contribution would be the people of Tyne Valley or Lenox Island, here's what we did. We cut a circle of wood from the handle of that knife. It's now the seat for the strap post, kind of in the butt end of the guitar there. We went back to Tyne Valley for the Oyster Festival, where they hold the championships. And people were from there from all across Canada there to compete. And they were coming up to where we had the guitar, and they were saying, "Oh, yeah, I've heard about this guitar. Where's Paul Henderson's stick? And where's Pierre Trudeau's canoe paddle? And where's Nancy Green's ski? And where's Joe's knife?" Right? They all knew who he was. These are just some of the teams that came to roar for Joe in their own way, including the Shuck and Awe team from Rodney's. That's Rodney who told me about Joe in the first place. Just part of the incredible LeBeau family that I still keep in touch with regularly. Leslie's not doing well at the moment. And I'm just so glad we got to put this guitar into Genevieve's hands before she passed away a few years ago. You probably know when you head down the 401 a little ways further, just outside of Montreal there's a roadblock, and you're asked to declare, are you a Sem-Viateur bagel person or are you a Fairmont bagel person? They are that, competitive between these two giants of the bagel-making world. But if you want to go with history, you kind of have to go with the Fairmont. It's the original, founded in 1919 by a Polish immigrant named Isidor Schlafman, the very first guy ever, believe it or not, to put sesame seeds on a bagel. Moved around the corner onto Fairmont Street in 1949, where it still sits today. And, of course, when you make a proper Montreal bagel, you put them in and out of the ovens on the long plank you call a shibba. Well, I got one of those shibbas from the Fairmount Bakery. We cut it into a couple of very thin strips. Those now run right down the middle of the back, kind of the spine of the guitar, as it were. That's the great-grandson of the founder. He runs things today. I did not let him put it in the oven. Everything was fine. I can actually show you a little bit more clearly where they are with this illustration here. They're the two lightest things very close together running down the middle. All that beautiful tigery looking stuff surrounding it, that's a spalted oak. It's from the largest oak timber frame building in North America, the oldest building in Winnipeg, built originally as the Convent of the Grey Nuns. Louis Riel went to school there for a year or two. His sister was a novice there. It's now the St. Boniface Museum. There's two dark strips on either side of the bagel pieces. Those are from a door frame from the center block of Parliament in Ottawa near the Prime Minister's office. And then running right down the very center is this piece of this grain elevator from Verigan, Saskatchewan. This is from the Dukobor community there, a Russian pacifist sect that came to Canada on a grant from Leo Tolstoy, the author. They had us out there for their Heritage Festival, which was amazing to be able to revisit the place with the guitar. And although it's one of those many dying prairie communities being emptied out by the big agribusinesses that surround it and kids moving away, there was very few people in that community under 55, 60 years old. But boy, everybody came out and had their portraits taken that day. It was a really special thing to be there. You know, there were so many different cultures and communities and characters represented in this project. There was one community that I was really trying to involve and having a difficult time with, and that was the Japanese Canadian community. I made the mistake of trying to deal with the Nikkei Center in Vancouver, and they were not responsive. And so by the time we were ready to build the guitar, we had nothing from the community. So I kept it in mind, thinking, well, maybe I'll find something at some point. And that's where Ken came in. And he's the one who told me originally about the Vancouver Asahi. Boy, what a revelation that was about this Japanese-Canadian baseball team founded in 1914, not allowed to play against white teams, only against other Asian, visiting Asian or Japanese-Canadian teams. But by 1930, they were the hot ticket in Vancouver. They played such a compelling brand of baseball, they called it brain ball, that you couldn't get a ticket. Everybody wanted to see them, and they were taking on all comers by that point. But then, of course, tragedy struck when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and all of a sudden, all of these Japanese Canadians, many of whom had never set foot in Japan, were declared illegal aliens, enemy aliens. They were shipped off to internment camps, many across the country, but mostly around British Columbia, and there's no way the team could survive that. But one of their jerseys did, and Ken put me in touch with the folks at the Japanese Canadian Cultural Center in Toronto, and after many months, years, I guess, 18 months, more than that, of negotiation, eventually what they permitted me to do was take a little bit of material from the back of the right-hand sleeve, I replaced that with a little fabric plaque acknowledging their contribution. And the material that they gave to me, we mounted on the front of the strap. And, of course, I wanted to make a big deal about this, that we had finally, plugged that hole in the inclusion of the guitar. So I called up the Toronto Blue Jays. They do an event every year around Canadian baseball history. So they had me down there for that event. Oh, my goodness, so cool. Got to hang out with Ace. He played on the field with the guitar, the Blue Jays mascot. And who was there but this woman here, Linda Ruth Tassetti Bambina. You know who she is? She's the granddaughter of Babe Ruth, whose first home run was hit in Toronto at Maple Leaf Field out on the island when he was with the Boston Red Sox in 1914. And then they did a big presentation about my project up on the Jumbotron, and Munenori Kawasaki came out and hammed it up with a guitar. That was so great. I miss him. I totally miss him. He was the spirit of the dugout for sure. They didn't play him a lot. But he knew all about the Asahi, because in Japan they just made a feature film about the team. And they presented me with this six-string Nation Blue Jays jersey, which I will treasure. So thank you, Ken, for putting all that in motion. Really amazing. Heritage Minute about the Asahi just came out a few months ago. There's one more story that I really have to tell you about. This is kind of the most extraordinary of all. As you can see, there's something not quite right about this tree. This is a Sitka spruce tree with no chlorophyll in its needles. Now, a tree with no chlorophyll probably shouldn't survive. It needs the green color to keep it cool and the oxygen to help it breathe. So this should have choked and burned up internally, but it didn't. It lived for 300 years, grew to 120 feet tall, and it could do that because it's protected by a number of different factors. For one thing, you can see there's other tall trees around it, so that really helps. Also, this is on Haida Gwaii. This is off the west coast of British Columbia. A lot of annual rainfall, low cloud cover a lot of the time, so that really, really helps. It was protected by the scientific community because people came from all over the world to study this tree. It was protected by the tourist industry because people came from all over the world just to see it. And protected, of course, by the Haida people, for whom this was a sacred tree, said to contain the spirit of one of their ancestors, a small boy. They called it Kid Kias, the golden spruce. And oddly enough, also protected by the Macmillan Bloedel Paper Company. Because, see, they had tree farm license 147, which would have allowed them to cut it down if they wanted to, but they knew that it was an important tree to different people for different reasons, so they kept a respectful perimeter around it, didn't cut near it. The problem was there was a guy who worked for them, mostly in the interior of British Columbia, as a logging scout. So his job was to go into the forest, sometimes for weeks at a time, by himself, if you can imagine, looking for new places to put in roads and pull out trees, basically planning the next clear cut. And after many years doing this work, he began to feel that Macmillan Bloedel wasn't behaving responsibly. And he decided it was really hypocritical of them that they would spare this one tree while they clear-cut millions of hectares of forest in British Columbia. Now, I think this is a story everybody should know. And if you want to know more, I'm not going to name that guy, but if you want to know his name and more of that story, read this remarkable book by John Valiant, The Golden Spruce. It should have been the Canada Reads book a few years ago when they did another of John Valiant's books. It was set in Siberia. It was a great book, too, but this is one we should all know. The part of the story I will tell you is that one night in November of 1997, this guy gets into his kayak at Prince Rupert on the mainland. He paddles across the fourth most dangerous stretch of water in the world, the Heckett Strait, at night. Paddles away down the Yacoon River, really more of an inlet, as you can see there, towards Port Clements, where the tree stands. Pulls his kayak up on the bank. Swims across the little channel there, carrying the chainsaw that he took out of it. And in the middle of the night, he cut down this tree. Now, it actually took 3 days for this tree to fall. He planned it that way. And the Haida people that I met said that for them, this was a drive-by shooting. This was a murder of someone in their community, and they couldn't understand why anyone would do such a thing. And they vowed at that point they would never touch this tree again. They just let it return to the earth in spirit and substance. And it remained this way on the ground for 9 years. But in 2004, I've been corresponding a bit with Dr. David Suzuki. I was trying to let him get him to let me put his name on my letterhead to try and attract sponsorship that I never got. But he was a demurring, very busy guy. And then I found myself at a World Literacy fundraiser where he was the guest speaker. And at the lunch afterwards, he came and he sat right next to me. So I introduced myself, and he said, "Oh, my goodness, Joey, I can't believe I'm meeting you today, because I've actually been thinking about you, and I've been thinking about your project, and I have an idea. Have you heard of the Golden Spruce?" I hadn't, so he told me the story that I just told you, and he said, "I think we can get a piece for your project." And he introduced me to some movers and shakers on Haida Gwaii, and we began a dialogue that took about 18 months, where they would ask me questions by email, I'd provide answers, they'd have community meetings, come back with more questions. And eventually they said, "Well, we think it's okay in principle, but we don't want to do anything without meeting you in person first," which was fine and fair, except that I never got any grants for this project. I'd already run my credit cards up way higher than I was comfortable with. They're still way higher than I'm comfortable with. But I knew that if we could get this piece, this would be the heart and soul of the project. So I threw caution to the wind, and knowing that we would have to do it properly with oversight and documentation, I flew 5 people out to Haida Gwaii with no promise of anything. All we did was we hung out at the Copper Beach Guest House, B&B in Masset. People would come and have tea with us. We'd go into the community, to the barber shop and the beauty salon and the coffee shop, and just talk to people. And eventually they said, "Well, people seem to like you okay. I think we can do this. We have a carver who is a hereditary chief in waiting. He's going to do the cut for you. There is a catch, which is that we won't do this without an elder present, and you need to know that all of our elders are really old. So it could be hard getting someone who can hike all the way into the forest with you like that." I said, "Listen, whatever happens is fine. I'm just glad to be here, heart in my throat." And on the morning of February 22nd, the phone rang at the guest house. It was Leo Gagnon, and he said, "We're good to go. We have an elder. His name is Frank Collison, and he's going to join us." And together we took a couple cars down to Port Clements, one of them with this little punt tied to the roof, carried that through the forest for about a 45-minute, an hour-long hike, got to the river, put it in, and took everyone over in a couple of shifts. And on the other side, this is what we found. Now, the truth is, we didn't know if there's going to be anything left of this tree. 9 years on the ground in a rainforest is a long time. It could have rotted just straight through. But you can see that the way that it fell, some of those upper branches snapped off and acted like legs. That kept it off the ground, kept some of the moisture out. And Leo walked up and down the length of that tree, tapping with the back of his axe as he went, till he found a spot about two-thirds of the way up. He fired up his chainsaw. And together we became the first people to cut into this tree since it had been felled in 1997. It was a remarkably emotional experience for everyone. We told some more stories. We stood back, did another little ceremony, and then just looked at this marvelous thing that had come out of this tree. I've spoken to folks in the community recently, and they say it's gone now. The tree has rotted straight through, so we got there just in time. At that point, Leo said to me, "Well, it's yours now. You got to carry it out of here." So it was about this big. I got that into the boat and over to the other side, up onto my shoulder for that hour-long hike back through the forest. Leo and I had been dining together and talking for the whole week before that, and he recognized that I cried easily, and he was like, "Oh, here he goes again." And as we're walking through the forest, he's behind me, he says, "There we go again, eh? Another white man walking out of the forest with our stuff." He had the last laugh, though. We went straight to a mill where we planed this piece off, wrapped that in blankets, sent it back to the luthier's workshop in Nova Scotia, and there it became the whole top of the guitar. I mean, it's really the face and the voice of this project. You want a spruce top for a guitar anyway? This is the best piece of spruce that ever was. And the rest of that material, we left with Leo. So he will spend the next decade or more making stuff out of it. When we went back to see him in 2008, he'd already started work on this mask that you see on the table in front of him. It's a mask of Kid Kias, the spirit of the tree, made from the tree. It wasn't finished then, but he wrote to me a couple years ago to let me know that it's done. It's a beautiful work of art. And I'm just so proud that Leo's mask and my guitar are kind of like cousins in the spirit of this tree. The event that took us back there was the Edge of the World Festival in Tillel on Haida Gwaii. And it was a remarkable thing to be able to re-engage people in that community with this thing that had had a tragic story for so long. All of a sudden, there was a new breath of life into it. So many folks from the community came out to get their portraits taken, including... that's one of my favorites, including Mo Ingram, who was this guy here who was introduced to us also as a cousin of the spirit of the tree. And Gujo, president of the Council of the Haida Nation, who'd been very useful and helpful behind the scenes, very powerful character on Haida Gwaii, a cultural renaissance man, a political leader, negotiating all the time with business and the province, and of course always wearing this poker face. So I never knew quite how he felt about the project, and when I took it back to his office on that trip, he didn't want to touch it. It terrified me. Like, I couldn't proceed without his blessing. Everyone else in the office wanted to take pictures and hold it. So we went to the festival. We were set up taking portraits of people. I see Gujo come into the fairgrounds from our perch, and I'm thinking, okay, please come and get your portrait taken. He went to every other spot around the perimeter of that festival, and I was terrified. But I look up at one point. There he is at my laptop registering to get his portrait taken. He steps in, gets his portrait. Huge relief for me. Still not much of a smile from Gujo, but not too bad. And then he said, you know what, I want one with you. So we had our portrait taken together. That felt amazing, and a bit more of a smile. Then he went away for a bit, and he came back with his daughter. There's the smile that I was looking for, just fantastic. Then he went away for a bit, and he came back with this guy, and then he went away for a bit, and he came back with these guys. He brought about 30 people up over the course of that day, and at the end of the festival, got up on stage and said, I want to thank Joey for bringing this guitar back to this community. I didn't realize what a powerful thing it would be, and I want to tell you, with this project, you've done something no politician could ever do. So in one day, from thinking he didn't like me to the best endorsement I ever could have got. It was an amazing day. So was this, the debut of the guitar on Canada Day on Parliament Hill in the hands of Stephen Fearing. I dreamed for 11 years his song, The Longest Road, would be the first song sung in it, and it was, although everyone who was on the bill that day played the guitar as part of their set. And we went back there for Canada Day on the Hill for the next 4 years running and got invited back again in 2016 to take part in the festivities there. After that, we just started traveling. At this point, we've clocked about 300,000 kilometers or so going back and forth across the country, visiting all kinds of places that mean all kinds of things to all kinds of people, including places that are actually in the guitar itself. So, for example, Fantan Alley, Canada's first Chinatown in Victoria, part of the original gate, is in the guitar. The Big Nickel in Sudbury is in there. Door molding from original De Havilland Beaver, the plane that opened the north, is in there. The Yukon Rose that helped build the Alaska Highway is in there. James Naismith's house, you already know where that goes. We did a house concert in the living room there. And I got a chance a couple of years back to wander through with the guitar inside John Ware's cabin. Putting the guitar in people's hands is kind of what it's all about. I haven't met anybody yet, and I know that includes every single person in this room, who doesn't have some connection to something in this guitar, or to a person who's played it, or a song that's been sung on it, or a place that it's been, or a place that it's from. And I know this because people tell me their stories. This guy came up to me at an event in Victoria and said, my dad was the announcer at the Montreal Forum the night of the riot and the night they brought the cup home. Awesome. And this guy, Kevin Tateishi, came up to me. He was a geologist working for surveyors in Cobalt, Ontario. And he came up to me after a presentation at the Miners Tavern, and he said, when you were talking about the Vancouver Asahi, I noticed that in the first row, that was my great-uncle Ken. He said, I knew he played on this famous baseball team, but I didn't know the story of it. So we made that connection in the most unlikely of places up there. You know, there's so many stories that are in this guitar, and that's perhaps why authors and poets seem to kind of use it as a story engine and develop songs and poems around it that kind of resonates for them. So literary heroes, fallen literary heroes, other kinds of heroes too, space heroes and dancers and rock stars and war heroes and hockey heroes and whatever kind of heroes you think those guys might be. We have added a bunch of key pieces to the case and the strap that I've already talked about. I'm not going to go through all of them, but you can see Karen Kane's tutu and Pierre Burton's bow tie and all kinds of stuff is in there. I do want to point out one in particular, though, and it's this one, Chris Hadfield's mission patch. We actually talked about him taking this guitar on his mission to the International Space Station. He said, listen, I love the idea. There is a serious catch, though, and that is, if I'm going to have it for my mission, it has to go up before me on the last U.S. shuttle mission. They're discontinuing that program. There's no room to bring a guitar back in a Soyuz capsule, so you will be giving me this guitar for all time. I wasn't quite prepared to do that, besides which he already had a guitar, which you've seen him play in YouTube videos, that was waiting for him up there. So instead, we got together. He played a couple of songs on my guitar. And at the end of our time, he gave me his mission patch, which we sewed into the case. I gave him one of my guitar picks. And a few months after he got back, I got this certificate from NASA with my pick attached, saying Commander Hatfield has flown this guitar pick for Six String Nation around the Earth 2,336 times. He'd like you to have it back. So I have a great souvenir from space from Commander Hatfield. People are always saying, oh, I have an idea, you know, why don't you put something from Gordon Lightfoot or Rush, or, you know, everybody wants me to put Canadian musicians in there. Well, I really didn't want to do that for a bunch of reasons. One, where would you end? To me, there's just too many amazing Canadian musicians, and who's going to feel left out? The role for musicians was going to be multiple. It just wasn't going to be being part of it. Now, there is some musical references in it, in that, for example, J.R.'s Bar, from Charlottetown, where Stompin' Tom got started, where Gene McClellan first sang Snowbird, all those great things that happened there. Part of that material is now the fretboard of the guitar. The drapery pin from the Théâtre Capitole in Quebec City is in the guitar. My personal favorite, though, Massey Hall. One of the original seats from up in the gallery section, seat number 69, is now what we call the headstock of the guitar. So in those ways, it involves the lives of musicians and the work of musicians and the resonances of musicians. And I figured, really, musicians' role is going to be to play this guitar, to bring it to life. That's going to be their kind of how they're going to do it. And this has happened on stages large and small across the country. David Leask recently wrote five songs about pieces in the guitar and has just recorded three of them. There's a mystery song still not indicated up there. You'll hear those soon. And we've gone to festivals and clubs and concerts and campfires all across this country and put this guitar in the hands of musicians. What's amazing to me about it, you know, guitar is a very personal instrument. It's a weird thing to have someone play a guitar that's not their own. But I watched this thing happen over and over and over again. You put the guitar in a musician's hands. They play it a little bit for themselves to kind of get a sense of its voice, as Murray did earlier. And then you think about, well, what do I want to play? What do I want to say while I've got this guitar in my hands? Which means we've heard every kind of music from every cultural background in every genre on stages, large and small. In every province and territory of Canada. I'm so proud every time someone brings this guitar to life. It's been played on huge stages and by little kids in schools and stuff. It's an amazing experience. I can tell you, Stompin' Tom played Bud the Spud on it, and we did finally get the guitar into Gordon Lightfoot's hands on his 70th birthday at the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto. There is one musician I decided I would make an exception to my rule of no musicians in the guitar, and that was Gord Downie. And that's because of the way he chose to live that last year of his life. It's not because I'm such a huge Tragically Hip fan, although I love them, but, you know, he lived it with such courage and such dedication and such transparency, such inspiration, and he kind of made that last year of his life like a grand rock spectacle. And with a cause, with a real purpose. And, you know, if you're going to turn your life into a rock spectacle, you need the outfit for it, right? So he had these leather suits, colored leather suits, made for him by Izzy Camilleri in Toronto. I was approached by a teacher in Kitchener-Waterloo who was a huge fan, who had bought these souvenirs that were fragments of material from seven of those suits, and she offered them to me. I said, well, that's a fantastic offer. I mean, I can't turn that down, but I don't really know how to incorporate them or what to do. So I called the person I knew would. That was my friend Karen. And she's actually the person who made Gord's hats for that final tour. And she said, well, it's so funny that you suggest this because I've actually got some material that I wanted to give to you too, some feathers and felt from Gord's hats. So I'd like to contribute that. She said, I can do some of the work. Problem is I don't have the machines that will mount it on that strap, that heavy leather strap. But I know someone who does. Turned out to be someone else I knew. His name is Jeff Churchill, and he made Gord's shoes for the final tour. And he had some leather left over. I don't know if you can see the little Tragically Hip logo stamped on the heel leather, and then the lyrics to Ahead by a Century printed on the sole. So he included those. I left the materials with those two for a couple of weeks, and they assembled them into these two delightful assemblies, one of which is mounted on the front of the strap, and one of them mounted on the back. So with that, we come to the strap. That means we come time to perform and time to hear it. I do not play guitar. So that's why we've recruited one of your own. Murray Humphrey is going to play. Murray, why don't you take your place up there? And while Murray's playing, I'm going to show you some of the portraits that we've taken of people holding this guitar. We've now taken about 150,000 portraits of 15,000 different people holding this guitar in every province and territory of Canada. The way it works is we do these mostly at festivals and some conferences and things like that. It's free to the public, and I think everyone thinks they're going to get one photo. So they all give us that sort of Hello Magazine goofy grin to start. And then I say, no, relax. We're gonna take lots. And we'll do 10, 15, 20, 30 pictures of everyone. And it's amazing because in that time, people sort of relax and become themselves. And I think that's what you'll see in all these portraits. You'll see people claiming they're part of Canada. Some of these people have waited 2 hours in the lineup to have these pictures taken, and you wonder, okay, what is it? It's like it's wanting to claim that part of the story for themselves, and it's such an honor. So I hope that you will enjoy the music and the photos.
Long before the water man and long before the wind and the green dog.
We run out the last couple of portraits here. Okay. Last three. Digging Roots. My sister, my niece and nephew. Jack Layton, Charlie Angus. So, thank you so much. There's one piece, and I wanted to mention it since we were here in this space. This is the Islamic Cultural Center in Quebec City. You might recall that on January 29th, a gunman entered that place and ended up killing six men and injuring 19 people. What really struck me is how they kept being called Muslims, as if that was the most important thing about them. They were people, they were Canadians, and that didn't make the news. It seemed to be an isolating kind of thing. And I think it was a thing that every Canadian should own, that this happened in this country, and it must never be allowed to happen again. I wanted to somehow pay tribute to these gentlemen, and so I reached out to the mosque, and they sent me swatch of the carpet from inside the mosque. It's now in the possession of a young textile artist. Her name is Lana Queter, and she has promised me that she is very close to having something that we will mount inside the guitar case in the next little while, so keep your eye on things there. So I hope in some way this is kind of reassembled, strengthened, I think an idea of Canada we all share. It's an inclusive place. It's a diverse place. It's a peaceful place. They're reflected in these faces. They're reflected in the music. And to me, once you've heard the music come to life in the hands of one of your own, it really is part of your story too. And you are now forever part of this story. There's lots more you can learn online at sixstringnation.com. You can connect to us on our social media channels and subscribe to the Instagram feed, which I know, Ken, you found interesting. It'll tell you about all the pieces I didn't get to in this talk. There is a book available as well. I would like to give a copy of the book for you to hold here so that anyone can look at any time. However, if you do want to buy one for your own private library, I have some books with me, and I can take credit cards and debit cards. How crazy is that? So if you'd like to buy a book, that's fine, and then I'm happy to sign it as well. There's also a little mailing list if you'd like to keep in touch. I do not send out a lot of newsletters or anything like that. In fact, I haven't done that in a long time. But if you'd like to keep up with developments in the project, you can sign up there. I also have these little packs of guitar picks available for sale as well. Look, there are a ton of people to thank for making this project happen. A handful of them are thanked here, but I'm actually going to do this backwards and thank the people who didn't help. And there was a lot. Like I said, I never got any grants for this project, and that wasn't for lack of trying. I knocked on so many doors, and they would all say, yeah, it's a great idea. It doesn't fit our program parameters. Go talk to that guy. And I got kicked around circles in Ottawa for years, and it was exhausting. And lots of people stood in the way. Lots of people said it couldn't be done or shouldn't be done. But every time I was about to give up, and that happened a lot, where I thought, I just can't do this anymore, somebody would step in, either with just a word of encouragement or a little check or sometimes a big check. But people just saying, no, you need to do this. This is important. Keep at it. And that's why it took 11 years to make this guitar instead of the 6 weeks it actually took to build it. And I'm kind of glad that it happened that way, because it means there's no official Department of Canadian Heritage approved sticker on it. There's no Tim Hortons sticker on it. This is really something that was made by people across this country who wanted to hear their story reflected back, and I think the project is better for it. I hope you feel better for having heard the story. I know I'm better for having been allowed to come and speak to you today and let you be part of this story and it be part of yours. So thank you so much.
Joey Taylor, thank you so much. You have touched the hearts and souls of every person in this room, as I'm sure you do everywhere you go with this amazing project. Thank you so much for creating this and for bringing it around and sharing it with Canadians. What an important project. Only one person could have done this, I think. You're the only one. I can't imagine how anybody else would have the success and the contacts and the perseverance and the whatever it all took to get this project done to completion.
Can I interrupt you for a second on that? Thank you so much. I mean, as you can see, I cry easily. And thank you for saying that. But I have to tell you all, this project is in real trouble. I'm really struggling. Again. And again, I know when I do the presentation in the room, people love it. But when I try and apply for the grant, nobody wants to talk to me. And when I try and reach out to government, they kick me down. They kick the can down the road. And I really need events. I really need schools. And of course, it's a tough time for schools right now in this province. So I'm looking to do more presentations across the country. And anyone you can think of who might have me speak at their annual corporate gathering or something like that, and pay the corporate rates, that allows this to keep going. And so just keep it in the back of your mind. When someone's looking for a festival or a school presentation, I'm your guy, and the sign-up form will be there for that too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Your sincerity and humility is obvious, and I don't think that without that you would have had the success that you've had in bringing all those pieces together in this. What makes you an individual, it's extraordinary. That you could make this dream come true is just an extraordinary inspiration for all of us.
Well, and you guys too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Joy will be seeing everybody at the end for a little with, you know, our receding line per usual. And then, as he says, we will set up a table where his book will be available for sale, and he'd be glad to sign it. And I don't know if whether Voyageur will join us and whether he'll be available for photos as well. That would be wonderful. I want to just invite everyone to sit for a moment and just reflect on what we've just witnessed and experienced here with Joy and Voyageur. I'll let you set that down and... I think this is probably the best time to do this, too. Joey, I wanted to thank you with a couple of things here. A couple of symbols of our gratitude for your being here. This is... You'll appreciate the synchronicity of this. This is from repurposed wood. Repurposed from the fuse that we've taken out of the front of this place. It is a candle holder.
That's awesome.
And I hope it will bring light to you and Voyager for many days to come. And because you are such a... Oops, where'd that go? You are such a source of light to us and to all Canadians with this project that you bring to everyone. I would like to give you a symbolic candle wick bracelet. We can fit that in there. There we go. And I can tighten that up. If I can. I'm not as good at it as some other people. Apparently that'll stretch back out again to fit better, but that is our candle wick bracelet, and it symbolizes you being a light to the world and to all Canadians here for sure. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, everyone. And
there's a little envelope in there with that $1 million check I was telling you about that'll help you on your way and fund all your experiences for the future. Thank you so much. If anybody here has any contacts for helping Joey find funding, or as Joey asked, for finding an outlet for this creative project to be presented to groups in Canada, please be sure to connect with Joey afterwards. Again, we'll just have a few minutes to reflect, and then we'll send everyone out. We all have dreams. It took over a decade, but Joey made his dream come true. He was the first one to tell us he didn't do it alone. He had lots of help. He had that support system that helped him when he was having doubts about whether to carry on, as I'm sure this must have happened more times than you even allowed. And I encourage all of you to be the light that helps achieve your dream of a better Canada. Go in peace, and happy Canada Day, West Hill.
Listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.